everyone. This is Electrical Wholesaling's latest Executive Insights podcast, and today we have a treat for you. We'll be chatting with Frank Hurt with River Heights Consulting. Frank's got decades of experience as a sales coach, a consultant, an author. He's got a long career selling electrical and automation supplies in both the distributor and manufacturing side of the market. Frank offers a unique and entertaining perspective I know you'll enjoy. He recently published another book, The New Sales Guys Project, that we'll be talking about. He's got some great reviews throughout the industry. And today we're going to learn a little bit about Frank's journey to his publishing of that work, and how salespeople can learn from it and become more effective salespeople. All right, Frank, kick things off. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background in this crazy industry? If you can weave in, you've got some fascinating interest outside the business that I think kind of add to this stew that you present here. And I think people would like to hear a little bit about it all.
Is a good word, perhaps. Yeah, my story is it is long and convoluted. So I'm going to try to give you the short version without taking out the flavor, okay? It's us keeping with our stew motto. I would like to tell everybody that I came to this industry because it was part of a master plan in life, but it wasn't. I like to tell everyone that I pursued a career that was well thought through and I dreamed of when I was a child, but I had no ideas of what the world could offer. And that's part of my love of this industry. My parents were in the distribution business. It was a small mom-and-pop thing in an industry called tires, batteries, and accessories in the oil business. My dad was a Texaco distributor. And also a distributor for a whole bunch of different tires and spark plugs and all that kind of stuff. That was my environment growing up. I started going to work with my dad when I was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. I did everything in the warehouse. I did, painting. And I painted more oil tanks than any person on the planet can even imagine, unless I grew up in that business. I always, when I was young, had this vision of going to work with my dad, becoming part of what was called Hurt Oil Company back then. When I was in college, something happened, and it was the Arab oil embargo. And that was kind of a wake-up call for my father, who sat down with my brother and I have a brother that's 3 years younger. And we were both thinking about, wouldn't it be cool to be in business with our parents? And he said, this business is not going to exist when you go. And we all had plans of going to college, but that changed my scope of what I wanted to study in college. So I quickly kind of went out and said, okay, what could I study that would guarantee me a good income? And that was computer engineering. This was back in the 70s when computers still ran on kerosene practically. So I'm going to college and studying this and thinking, okay, I'm going to go to work for Bell Laboratories, if IBM would sell one of these companies, and I'll be a great computer engineer. And midway through that, during the summer when I was working with my dad, I met this gentleman who was a sales engineer for a company in our industry and a related industry to electrical engineering. And this is what I noticed. His name was Ed. Ed had a fancy car. He wore nice clothes. He got to stay in hotels and eat in restaurants, and he never got his hands dirty unless he was doing something as a hobby. And it made my 20-year-old brain start going, sales engineering, that has a nice ring to it. So I decided that I was going to be a sales engineer. I told all my professors I'm going to be a sales engineer, and they all kind of went, holy cow, you're going to throw away all your studies to do this. I graduated, and back then it was a good time to come out of school. We were coming out of a recession. People were hiring, and engineers were in demand. I interviewed with a company called Allen Bradley. And I'd also interviewed with all the computer people and everything like this. But there was a thing about Alan Bradley that attracted me. There at the time were a privately held company. They at the time were dealing with distributors, which I knew something about, and I really liked. And they told me stories about the new level of technology, that the things of PLCs that were just, I mean, to say they were in their infancy would be an understatement. I would say that they were newborns back in those days. And so I became enamored with that and was fortunate enough that they asked me to come on board. And I liked my job. I liked what I did. I loved the interactions with the customers and with distributors, and made lots and lots of friends that I just felt like, this is an industry that I like and I want to stay in. But somewhere along the line, after about 2 or 3 years, this thing in the back of my mind about being an entrepreneur started kicking in. And I really wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I thought, okay, I'm going to start my own business. But first, I'm going to stay with Alan Bradley for 7 years and learn everything I can about business and everything I can about the business. And I found new friends, became more enamored with it, loved what I was doing. And instead of 7, it turned into 14 years. But that the whole time this entrepreneurial thing was going off and off and off in my mind, I started looking for an electrical distributor that I might be able to buy. And I had made reasonably good money and saved more than most people. We'll put it that way. My wife complained constantly, why don't we spend some of this money instead of saving everything? but my goal was to save enough to buy a company. And it was, it was in the mid 80s. The price of electrical distributors was going up, and it was just out of reach for a person to do. And I had an opportunity then to become an equity partner with one of my distributors. It was a company called Van Meter in Iowa. Jim Hope was the owner, and he and I were friends because he was one of my distributors. And I like to do business with friends. I make people friends so that I can do business with them more. So I ended up going to work there, and we were really successful. I discovered that I love the business, and I kept making, and this is maybe the story of my life, I keep making friends and wanting to do more with my friends. Mm-hmm. And during that time, we were really fortunate. We grew the business from $17 million to over $160 million during those 14 years. And I had the opportunity to be on distributor advisory councils. I had the opportunity to expand branches. I had the opportunity to do millions of things. And I was also lucky enough because of our Alan Bradley ties, kind of had one leg in the electrical business and one leg in the automation business. Mm-hmm. I was selected to be the president of the Association of High Technology Distribution. So guess what? Another whole giant group of friends and I just couldn't get away from that. And in 2005, we sold the business to our employees through an ESOP trust, which is a fabulous thing for the employees. Mm-hmm. But I decided at that time, because in my time with AHTD, the Association for High Technology Distribution, in my time with them, I had a chance to meet some really incredibly talented consultants. And I started looking and going, okay, I want to be an entrepreneur. That's an entrepreneur. I don't have to invest in warehouses. I don't have to invest in a million things. It's just going to be me and my brain and the world. And so I decided after we sold to go out into that business. Mm-hmm. And it's been 18 years, which is a new world record for jobs for me. 14 years with Allen Bradley, 14 years with Van Meter, and now 18 years here. And I've got to meet more people around the world, even other countries are adopting the U.S. model for distribution. And what makes it even cooler is it's a moving target. They want to be just like the United States, and they come to the United States. But by the time they get home, the United States is different. And I'm attracted to that. It's been a learning thing. Mm-hmm. I just love to learn. Now, what in the world does a guy like me do for hobbies and do when I'm not working? Mm. Well, first of all, work is my hobby. I have a wonderful thing where, you know, I can call anything work. I'm going to read a book over the weekend and that was recommended by one of my clients. Well, that's kind of work, and I'm going to get the thrill of reading it and enjoying that. But my wife keeps going, "You need hobbies. You need hobbies." And I've got a couple. I've had a lifelong love affair with music. It started when I was in third grade. We went to a town where they had free musical instrument lessons for any kids that could that would volunteer. I did that, and you know, here I am. You know, let's see. I'm good to do that. That's well more than 50 years, probably closer to 60 years. That I played musical instruments and played in bands and done all kinds of things, which was something that I had to put aside when I was working in a career that just took all my time and I was constantly traveling. Mm-hmm. So I've done that. I like to fix bicycles. I like to ride bicycles. I'm amazed that you can travel so far and so fast on your own human power on a bicycle. And so I have a bunch of guys that are, you know, the junkers. I think every town has them. They drive down alleys and look for things that are made out of metal that they throw in the back of some ragtag pickup truck, and then they take to the junkyard and sell. I've got three or four of them trained that if they see bicycles that are in the trash, they get them and they bring them by here by my office and go, "Hey, I got a couple. Are you interested in any of them?" And so, I'm now the proud owner of like 25 bicycles in various states of repair. I fix them over the winter, and we give them to kids whose parents can't afford a bike. Going back to the music thing. I have a group of people that I play music with every week. They range from the head engineer for the local power company, a person who was retired head of maintenance from Alcoa, to a person who runs a fleet of trucks that pick up trash, and we play every week, and I've had at least three or four people from our industry who happen to be coming in. We talk, we find out that we are. And our industry has got a lot of closet rockers in the in its world. And I think that they've even had that at a couple of the NAD meetings. Yeah. And I really think that that's the coolest thing ever. And it's a fabulous way for people to connect.
How do you knit it all together, Frank? The people from your outside industry, you mentioned the people in the band, you mentioned the people around town that help you out with things, but you also have, you had the background in automation, electrical. I know with your consulting, you've gotten into some other distribution niches. What are some of the common denominators kind of that work for, you know, salesperson? And I know you get into some of those in the most recent book, but does it all kind of come together at some points for you?
I think it does. I also think that regardless, and I call our industry a knowledge-based distribution. Mm-hmm. Here's what I mean by that. There are some forms of distribution where it's really you want a brown box, and we have the brown boxes on our shelf, and I can get those to you. You do not have to know anything about your product. You only have to know I can get it to you tomorrow. In our industry, as well as the automation industry and the other industries that I work, which are all adjacent to the electrical industry, there is no such thing as a pure electrical distributor anymore. If you go to an electrical distributor, you're going to find electrical distributors that carry pneumatic controls, which, you know, used to be a separate industry. You're going to find pneumatic distributors that have automation controls. You're going to find automation distributors who are ranked in the top 100 of electrical distributors. So when you look at that, there's a lot of similarities in this knowledge-based world. But here is what I see as the common denominator. The first thing and is that people in our business have relationships with their customer. I make this point in my book, and it's really the reason why I wrote a book for new salespeople, because I kept having people call and say, Frank, I got a new guy. What book would you recommend that he read? I've got maybe 100 linear feet of books on sales. It's my hobby, so I get to do that. I have 200 linear feet of books on the Civil War, which is another area I like to read about. But what I started going through the books, and I'm literally at the bookshelf going book by book by book by book. Okay, which one of these is going to be good for a new sales guy? Which of these is going to be good for a new sales guy? And I could not come up with anything. And here's the reason why. Of all of these sales books, most of them are written for people that do what I call transactional sales. This is the guy that's selling you a computer system. It is a one-time event. Maybe it happens, you know, once every 5-10 years, but it's mostly a one-time event. He comes in, he asks you some questions about your business, and then he pitches his product. Real estate people, even though there are people that say, well, I've got this relationship with my real, it's really a one-time event. Either you make a purchase or you don't. In our industry, it's an ongoing. So theirs is like a lake. Ours is like a river. The relationship, the relationship flows. And as it flows, it could be possible that you could come in and see a problem that the customer's having. You could, or the customer comes to you with a problem that they're having, and your solution might not be selected, but the behavior that you display could become the thing that starts the river flowing in your direction for the next 20 years. And so that is something that I see as important for any, whether it's manufacturer, whether it's an electrical wholesaler, whether it's an automation wholesaler, and it doesn't really matter what kind of customers you have. It's that you have to develop a relationship, and not to confuse relationship with, well, okay, how's the weather and how's your golf game? Which incidentally, for the record, I hate golf. Instead of that, I'm talking about a relationship with the customer and the contacts in the customer. Understanding each one of those are going to be different. I think that the best salespeople place a high value on their customer's time. So there's no calls where it's just like, and I literally met someone 40 years ago whose opening statement for every visit that he made was, you don't have anything you need to buy today, do you? And every time he did that, I just wanted to slap him, but you know, it wasn't my job to do that. But because the obvious answer was no. If you're just coming into the customer to say, hey, I was in the neighborhood and I thought I'd stop it, that's showing no. The customer may love you, but he may hate the fact that you're here today because you're going to waste 5 minutes of his time. And I think this is getting worse and worse because the new generations, and I'm not one of those people that say, golly geez, these millennials or anything, because I love the idiosyncrasies and think that an old time baby boomer like me has learned a lot of things from the Xers and the and the millennials and all the rest of them. But one of the things that the younger generation puts a lot higher value on than people in our time is work-life balance. And so if you come in and waste a half hour of their time, that half hour of time translates into them being required to work a half hour longer than they knew, than they needed to. And in some companies, some of the really progressive companies are even saying to people, we're hiring you to do your job. You don't have to punch a clock, come and go, you know, as you need. And so then that salesperson really creates an issue. So understanding the value of your customer's time, but also understanding your own time is worth something. To say, okay, I want to make sure that every call has a purpose, every call has a value, and that I'm bringing some value to my customer. The best salespeople also make use of teams. When I was a salesperson back in 1978, and I got into my really cool 1974 Mercury Marauder that had a V8 engine that got 12 miles to the gallon on the open road, I was pretty much said, okay, here is your territory. My sales manager took me out on a week-long loop to introduce me to all the distributors. And after that, I was alone. I had no team. It was me. And, now it's, I can't think of a single distributor or manufacturer that's anything. Maybe a startup might not, but I can't imagine any of those people that don't have teams. And the best salespeople figure out ways to motivate their team and to manage their team, even though those people do not report to them or are not paid for them. And a lot of people get hung up in the thought of saying, well, I'm not their boss. I can't tell them to do something and go. You can't tell them. The best leaders make people want to do things. They want to help you. And that's true for both distributor and manufacturer. The manufacturer people have to understand, as well as the distributor people have to understand, that the distributor is on the manufacturer's team and the manufacturer is on the distributor's team. And even though they may work with other people, they're still part of your team. If you can figure out ways to motivate them and convince them to do things for you, then life is good.
I keep thinking back to the book, and you said you interviewed about 200 people, in the preparing the book. And I was just curious, what were their, did they understand that kind of innately?
That I love talking about that because the people that I talked to had one thing in common, and that they had been in sales for under a year, and that's where the name of the book came from, The New Sales Guy Project. It came because a couple of them called and said, hey, I'm your new sales guy, and I'm here for for my weekly call. Each one of those people, it started off with a couple of clients that I said, yeah, I'll work with your new people because I couldn't recommend a book for them to read. So I started doing that. I found I kind of liked it. I found that after doing a half dozen or so of those coaching, mentoring kinds of things, that Well, what I discovered is the same issues being brought up over and over again. And so I decided I want to expand this so that I have a better understanding than just six people. And so I posted in my blog, and I told people when I went out to conferences and things, say, if you have any new salespeople, have them give me a call. I will mentor and work with them for free as long as they meet my requirements. You know, you had to be prepared. A lot of the things that I outlined for these young people was the same as a mentor that I had outlined for me. And his comments were that, Frank, I'm helping you out, not because you work for me, not because you even work for my company. I'm helping you out because I like you as a person. I see something in you that reminds me of me and something in you that I will be a success. And I'm going to give you some homework. And the first time you don't have that homework done, we're done. And if I recommend that you do something, you're gonna do it my way for at least a year. And then you're gonna come back. And if you've done it my way for a year, you can come back and explain why your way is better. and one instance of this is, Here is a book. You can't tear pages out of it. You have to write and leave the stuff in it for forever. You have to make notes to yourself and follow-ups and ask each and every one of your customers if you can take notes during the call. And so I insisted that that be one of the ground rules for them. And over the course of time, one of the things that that really kind of set me on a loop was that there were some very, very quality young people, and they were both men and women, who left our industry because of frustration that they felt in their early times. And they had gone to their sales manager and they'd come to me and shared those frustrations. And they just did not feel as though those frustrations would ever go away. And this began as a phenomenon sometime in the latter part of the book. And I restructured some things to let people know that there are some things that a new salesperson has to master early on, that once they master it, and once they get good with it, they won't ever have to do it again, which is kind of a strange thing. But I'll give you the example. For when I was a young salesperson, and I think this holds true with most sales managers. When I was a young salesperson, customers had lobbies. They had receptionists. You wanted to talk to someone and you could come to the receptionist. And if you came with the right mentality and with the thing of I'm here to help and not to sell, they would ultimately steer you to the right person. Mm-hmm. If you called someone live answered the phone. Nowadays, that is gone. Yeah. It is completely gone. Mm-hmm. The frustration of setting appointments with new customers, mm-hmm. even customers that had done business with their company for years, mm-hmm. it is so high. And I tell people, just do this process. And if you do this process for a year, at the end of that year, you'll never have to do it again because customers will reach out to you or they'll mm-hmm. know you well enough to return your mm-hmm. phone call. Because mm-hmm. now it takes on average of 6 or 7 phone calls and emails just to get conversation mm-hmm. with someone that says, mm-hmm. I want to talk to you. And Lord help you if you start off that conversation as, I want to talk to you about our products. The guy's going, oh, I already buy your products. Or what's even worse is, and I'm kind of digressing, but when I was a young salesperson and when I was a young sales manager and a distributor, we taught salespeople to lead with a line card. Everybody has a line card. Mm-hmm. And most people have very, very nicely, it's printed on cardstock, shiny paper. It is cool. It tells the history of the company. And it's got all of these 300 and some companies that the distributor represents. And this is like, they're taught to bring it in a little special case and present it to the customer with two hands, like they do in Asia with business cards. And you think of how valuable is that today? With a 20-second Google search, they know all about your, and they're so busy, they don't have time to look and go, oh, well, yeah, you do have a lot of line. No, if they needed to buy your products, they would. And so one of the other things we talk about in the book is the unsales sales call, because that first visit should never, ever be about products. It should never, ever be about your company. Instead, it should be, you know, hi, I'm Frank. I'm now you can use your imagination for this. I'm Frank and I'm a 25-year-old kid and I'm your new salesperson from the electrical distributor. And they go, oh no. But instead, if you go, we have some solutions and some products, and I think that your company might be someone that could benefit from them. Can we talk just a little bit about your company? Tell me how you go to market with this. Tell me about your business. How do you make those? Do you have a plant somewhere else? You get the customer talking about that. And then in the conversation, things happen. Magic happens. The customer says, well, I'm having problems with electrical safety. Instead of immediately reaching in your briefcase, let me grab this out and show you this brochure. You go, I think that I might be able to help you. Can I think about this for a week and call you back? And doing that says two things. Number one, it says that I'm not just a drive-by salesperson. I'm going to be in your life for a long time. It also throws the customer off a little bit because they expected you to launch into a sales pitch. And instead you're going, I have to think about what you said. Yeah. And I'm going to come back with a couple of thoughts for you to consider.
Yep.
And so you come back in a week or maybe 2 weeks and you say, I've been thinking about what you said about electrical safety. Our company has several products that deal with electrical safety. We may even have an electrical safety expert here, but you mentioned this and here's something that I think, are you familiar with this product? And then all of a sudden the conversation is flow.
You're trying to solve their problem. You take putting the focus on their problems rather than on what your company is selling and you're being a solution provider. Yeah.
Yeah. Which another thing I say in this, because it's about asking your customer questions. I tell people time and time again, never ask a question that you don't want to know the answer to.
Well, we covered a lot of ground today, Frank. I mean, we could probably go for another hour on some of the different avenues of different things you've covered in your book and that you've seen the changes in the business. I hope we get a chance to chat again sometime soon of all this. And I'm looking forward. I haven't picked up my copy of the New Sales Guy Project just yet. I know it's available on Amazon. It sounds like it's going to be a really good read, and it sounds like you're getting some really good feedback on it so far. I hope we can help you get the word out on that.
I have a little section in the back of the book that asks everybody who's a new salesman that's reading it, that if they like it and they want to get a free coaching session from me and be invited to a special group that we set up for new salespeople to share ideas, all they have to do is send me a picture of them holding the book.
Thanks to our listeners today for listening to another Executive Insights podcast. I appreciate it.